way government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time the Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. I'm so glad to see you back here today. I have an expanded program ready for you today. There's a lot to share with you. Things are changing so quickly. Right now, we are, 30 days, 19 hours, 55 minutes, and 3 seconds away from the citizens' hearing on disclosure on April 29th. The whole entire world is changing around us. I had someone write me an email, and they sent me the full videotape of when the Disclosure Project went to the National Press Club back in 2001. And for the first time, I watched it because I had only seen snippets. I had watched several snippets through the years, but I had never seen these guys stand up and testify. And it was much different witnesses than are going to be at the citizens' hearing on disclosure. They were military guys. A lot of them were military guys, or they were working in some official capacity. And I was so touched by it. What I want to do on Monday and Tuesday is I want to just play that. I want us to review where we came from. Remember, on May 9th, 2001, all of these guys got up with outstanding reputations and lifetime careers saying our government has engaged with an extraterrestrial presence and they're not telling you. And 4 months later, we had 9/11. Like as if there had to be a kibosh put on the truth coming out. So now 11 plus years later, we're in a different, very, very, very different place. And now it's a celebration. And so we're on the heels. We're in the preparation mode of the Easter holiday, among other holidays. But as Sananda, as the commander of the New Jerusalem, and with the lifetime of Jesus having come to an end where nobody got it and it wasn't time for ascension then, and now we're in the master plan again and we're doing the citizens' hearing on disclosure, it so much feels like everything's unfolding in the light now. being that it's Good Friday, Good Friday represents a time where everything's cleared away. The old is dissolved, and we're preparing for the ascension of the Christ within ourselves. So that's why I want to share so much with you today. We're going to go to one of our eyewitnesses that we're featuring, Peter Davenport. But before we do that, I want to share a couple of pieces with you that I'm going to read, because this is vital information I'd like you to go into Easter with. And today I've been asked by Sananda to write a new message, an Easter message, and also by Ashtar. So I will put that out later today. Ashtar and Sananda would like to put out an Easter message, so we're going to do that today. What I want to do first is, on March 17th, I had put out a channeling from Sananda, and it's called Sharing Unlimited Abundance of the Creator's Love. And I think not everybody saw it, and maybe everybody hasn't heard it. And it's a very important message for right now, as we continue to do our work of bringing forward the information, asking President Obama to give us disclosure. This is a form of abundance consciousness, that we can have everything that we've always wanted, and it's time now. So I want to start out by sharing this message. After this, I have found on the front page of BBC News an article about the ISS, which I can't believe they posted it, but it's a sign that the media is cluing into this message. I'm going to give you some background information and share the BBS article. Then we'll go look at Peter Davenport. I want to then give a special presentation from Richard Hoagland that I think you will enjoy very much. It's the perfect material for a Friday afternoon. And if you stay around long enough, I'd like to share a meditation with you at the end. This is Sharing Unlimited Abundance of the Creator's Love, a message from Sananda. Greetings, this is Sananda reporting to you from 10 forward on the New Jerusalem. Many of you have the feeling since 12/21/12 that you cannot see anything changing. I am bringing you an update and a taste of things to come. On December 21st, 2012, a galactic center alignment allowed a full open flow of energies to Earth. Allow me to explain it deeper. Albert Einstein had hypothesized about 13 dimensions. The first 12 dimensions are in the physical realm, and Earth is at the fifth dimension and then some. The 13th dimension is accessed through galactic center in the light matter or antimatter realm of light. Everything there is white light and formless. With the astronomical alignment, a clear path was made available for merging with these high energies. On January 21st, 2013, Earth nuclear engineer M.T. Keshe put out a call for all countries to sign a world peace treaty. To date, approximately 19 countries, including the United States, Russia, China, Australia, Peru, Bolivia, and Japan, have signed. There are more than 190 countries in the world, and so we could see improvement. Dr. Keshe has set March 21st as the date to release the new technologies to these governments who have signed the World Peace Treaty. On February 11th, 2013, Pope Benedict resigned. He was forced to step down. We have always said that the arrest of the Pope for war crimes was the sign to look for. We are ready to see a big shift. The new Pope Francis, named after Francis of Assisi, is not the one wearing the outer clothing of Jorge Mario. This soul is being overlighted by the Master Kutumi, and he himself is now an angelic soul which took up residence here. This was part of the master plan. This will allow the necessary healing for millions of Catholics without destroying their entire faith in God. All is in divine order. Allowing this dispensation helps Catholics move forward with their ascension. On March 15, 2013, the largest ever coronal mass ejection released from the sun flooded Earth on March 17, 2013, with necessary downloads of light codes and light language from the stars through the winged white lions to be shared with humanity by sequential, repetitive sound harmonic vibrations and frequencies, data streams, and language of light communication that will be pulsing through the sacred space of the divine heart when the time is ready near disclosure. On March 27th and the days which follow, a follow-up grander influx of divine energy, larger than what happened on December 21st of 2012, will flow to Earth, opening the heart center of every child, woman, and man, and it will activate all those who are prepared to receive upgrades on the 12 strands of DNA. This will enable everybody to access higher knowledge, and it will continue to the process of lighting the crystalline body in each one. You will recall and remember who you are, where you came from, and why you are here. As that is completed, you will no longer need to experience dysfunction on any level of your expression. You are encouraged to ask your inner self for help from higher beings to restore any weakness in your physical vehicle. The spirit doctors will help if you ask and allow. April 12th will be a light gathering of galactics, ascended masters, angels, and those from other realms of light from many dimensions will gather together on Earth for the purpose of anchoring this large influx of energy, creating a magnetic anomaly bubble in which disclosure will occur. The activities at the release of the Sirius movie and the citizens' hearing will be coordinated through the ACIO with the highest beings of light as they assist Earth through this transition. April 22nd is the release of the Sirius documentary. April 29th, the week-long citizens' hearing on disclosure in Washington, D.C. Throughout April, there will be on-site activations of the great sun disks deep inside Earth, linking those on Earth with the ships, transmitting the light codes and harmonics for new Earth. Can you see with eyes that see? You are watching disclosure and announcements unfolding right in front of you as a sequential flow of events. Things are happening. These events are carefully timed out to prepare all of humanity to receive these gifts in due course. Even those ones working at the highest levels to accomplish disclosure and announcements are not always aware of the forces working with them. Connect your heart lights with the intention of the highest good for all involved as we march ever nearer to changeover at zero point. Join your consciousness together in oneness. As we move forward, utilizing the light cities as spoken about before by Archangel Michael through other sources, we will take some time to heal Mother Earth. Much needs to be done in every aspect of life. In the years which follow, we can see Earth moving back through the Eye of On. The Eye of On is the Great Mother's through which closing and opening of her eye, creation, sustentation, and retraction, suppression, and promotion occur. We will learn to travel in our Merkaba bodies through the star at Orion's belt called Al-Nilam, or On. This process will take us back through the three great rings of energy, which is called the Central Sun, or Alcyon. These appear as rings, the same as the rings around Saturn. The Central Sun is an etheric stargate, which is three rings, which step up our energy in a progression of three in order to prepare the frequency of our Merkaba bodies to travel out to the antimatter universe called On. It is very, very important to meditate so these skills may be acquired. Meditation is how one accesses their Merkaba body for unrestricted travel to these other realms of pure light. On is the light matter universe twin to our dark matter universe of Nebadon. You are loved beyond belief. Call to me as you integrate new intelligence and have questions which require answers. I am always beside you, guiding you, the ground crew on earth. This is Lord Sananda. Now, what I'd like to do is share a little background information with you before I share the BBC story. Sorry. This is an article that I wrote myself. It's not channeled. I put this article out on March 26th, and it's called Disclosure, Announcements, and Nisara, The Big Picture, Part 3. On April 15th, 2010, President Obama gave a speech at the Kennedy Space Center at NASA. He disclosed a vital piece of the puzzle for the secret space program, but no one noticed. He said, "That's the story of NASA. And it's a story that started a little more than a half century ago, far from the space coast, in a remote and desolate region of what is now called Kazakhstan, because it was from there that the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first artificial satellite to orbit the Earth, which was little more than a few pieces of metal with a transmitter and a battery strapped to the top of a missile. But the world was stunned. Americans were dumbfounded. The Soviets, it was perceived, had taken the lead in a race for which we were not yet fully prepared. The secret space program effectively began on July 7, 1947, when they changed the story of the Zeta Reticulum ship being run off course when we messed with the radar waves, which made their instrumentation veer off course and crashed their craft. Jesse Marcel Sr. said the debris they picked up was metal no thicker than the foil from a cigarette packet, but if you put a sledgehammer to it, it did not bend. He was in charge then in the United States and the Pacific for the Army of all air-terrain radar mapping systems, and he said that metal was not of this world. When Sputnik was launched, members of the United States military and intelligence and their counterparts in the Soviet Union, who were both under contract with the negative extraterrestrials at the time, fabricated a cover story together. How else were they going to siphon money off their national budgets undetected for the next 65 years? Sometimes they worked together, and do to this day on the multiple international space stations going out to deep space, bringing back payloads which would blow your mind. Back in 1960, when Sputnik circled the Earth, Americans were dumbfounded. An artificial cold relationship was crafted by the governments of the United States and Russia, who were allies in World War II. They felt if they threw together a few pieces of metal with a battery strapped to the top of a missile and a transmitter to show us its route while in flight, it would effectively cause a competition between the two countries. It worked. It has worked for 65 years. How much longer will you be lied to? How much longer will you allow money to be spent on something you do not know a thing about? In 1961, President Kennedy made his famous speech asking for Americans to prepare to travel to the moon. President Obama said at NASA in 2010, the Soviets, it was perceived, had taken the lead in a race for which we were not yet fully prepared. In 1961, the United States National Security Agency, NSA, which had been born out of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, landed on the moon with NSA astronauts. President Kennedy was well aware of this. When he decided to whistleblow, then he did not make it. NASA was a cover story. NASA was a civilian agency. NSA was under the Department of Defense. NASA received its funding and from that money was put into technologies put into place by reverse engineers and the private contractors working for DOD. Reverse engineers took the spacecrafts shot down by the U.S. military and reverse engineered anti-gravity devices and more. Lockheed Martin is one example where a company builds bombs to launder money from war into the secret space program, while at Skunk Works is building secret technologies for the secret space program and making money hand over fist on both ends. Do you think all of these private contractors like Boeing want you to have full galactic disclosure and end their honeypot? Zero Point Energy, which the Keshe Foundation is equipped to release to the world, would end all war. These military, intelligence, government, and private contractors would have all their excessive income go away, as well as likely see jail sentences for breaking their oaths of office, and more. The "and more" part is we would never use oil again. So the oil companies and the hedge funders also will lose their income. Since 1961, NSA has been running flights to the moon and Mars, sometimes weekly. Large payloads were taken to the moon from the space elevators in Diego Garcia and Sri Lanka. You could easily see them from Google Earth. Take a look. This is how they built the structures on the moon and Mars. The New York Times wrote three articles on the National Space Council between 1989 and 1991 about how ex-NASA chief Richard Trulli was going to blow the whistle on the Bush administration about the billion-dollar budget being spent on the moon and Mars. Bush Sr. fired him and closed the National Space Council and sealed the records. How much longer will you allow money to be spent on something you know nothing about? Why do you think the United States mints all the extra dollars they need to pay off the private contractors and others working for the secret space program? The disclosure and advocacy movement of exopolitics has been holding meetings for years, exposing these and other truths, but no one is listening. On May 9, 2001, Dr. Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project held a meeting at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., where many witnesses who had been to the biggest events in UFO history came forward and explained to the world about the ongoing truth embargo. Less than 2 months later, President George W. Bush left for Texas, where he spent 91 days at his ranch instead of in the White House. George Bush Sr. and Dick Cheney, with Donald Rumsfeld and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers, with several others, planned 9/11. They worked all summer, and on the morning when Alan Greenspan was at the World Trade Center, the financial headquarters of the United States, to publicly begin to announce provisions of NASARA law, Dick Cheney, working from 50 stories below the White House with NSA operatives, worked the joystick flying the missiles into the towers and the Pentagon. It was so much worse than duping people with the first missile called Sputnik. It set NASARA law enactment back 11 years and counting. Do you think you can connect the dots between disclosure announcements and NASARA? They say hindsight is 20/20 vision. How much longer are you going to allow money to be spent on something you know nothing about? You wonder why Congress refuses to make things better. On April 29th to May 3rd, 2013, there will be a citizens' hearing held for the first time in 45 years concerning extraterrestrials at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House and 12 blocks from the Capitol. Some 40 or 50 witnesses will give testimony to former Congress members, and it will be filmed for a documentary called The Truth Embargo. This is being produced by the executive director of Paradigm Research Group, Stephen Bassett. There will be a live stream available for a nominal fee all week. It is important that together we witness the disclosure of the secret space program, from the whistleblowers, witnesses, and researchers who have dedicated their lives to telling the truth. To arrange live streaming of the event, visit citizenshearing.org. Archives of the event will be free to all with no suppression of the information. Later, the Truth Embargo documentary will be available in theaters around the nation. As Earth citizens, it is our responsibility that we participate in action politics and ask our elected officials to come clean. President Obama just may be prepared to do this. It is possible he has been preparing for lifetimes to do just this. President Obama will be the disclosure president. This will pave the way for announcements and enactment of Nasara law. First, we the people must ask him to. You may help by signing a petition. Can you spare 2 or 3 minutes to sign a petition? If you are over 13 years old and a citizen of Earth in any country, you are eligible to sign. We need 100,000 signatures. Can I count on you to spread the word in social media? There are millions of people all over the world who have been contactees and or abductees, and they know for certain that extraterrestrials are real. Millions. Can we get 100,000 signatures? Please sign the petition here. wh.gov/HQQE. Until Earth citizens acknowledge between themselves and their elected officials that there has been an engagement between ET and their governments, they will not decloak and land on Earth. Why would they? There are superficial issues which relate to NASA flights and deeper questions which deal with NSA flights, which were occurring 8 years before the first NASA astronauts did arrive on the moon. NSA craft and ET crafts were parked on the moon when NASA arrived. So they were both fake and real flights. Only the NSA flights, with the help of negative ETs, were allowed to continue. NASA was thrown off the moon by the negative ETs and NSA and told not to come back. That is why NASA never went back to the moon. The covert operations within the moon structures were not to benefit we the people, but only a few haughty souls who today do not mind watching you starve and lose your homes. The bankers and the mortgage underwriters. Enter Nasara Law. The secret space program uses an academy across the highway, inside a mountain from the Air Force Academy. The real NSA astronauts fly the ultra-top secret TR-3B, Aurora, and other anti-gravity equipped craft like the Shark helicopter designed by reverse engineers. Today, there is not one International Space Station, ISS. There are many. The civilian agency NASA uses 2 power units on the ISS, the typical rocket thrusters of the typical launch. Secretly, they have another puzzle to display. Another booster, the second booster that cuts in far above prying eyes. They're using a propulsion technology that effectively transforms a megaton platform into one weighing only a few pounds and sends them on to many strange places far from their supposed objectives. This is how they service many secret space platforms. We have many of these so-called ISS platforms. They can launch one of these and get to where they can rendezvous with their target days ahead of conventional craft and in silence. That's a pretty closely kept secret. How much longer are you going to allow money to be spent on something you know nothing about? On the ISS, off-planet scientists and astronauts work together with Earth astronauts on joint missions. A few of the other major players have been involved from the beginning, including the Palladians, Arcturians, Antares, Andromedans, Procyon, Lyra Vega, Virgo, Orion constellations with planets which reach across quite a polarity spectrum, Dracos, Ursa Major Bear, Ursa Minor, Leo, Sag, Zeti, inner planets Venus, Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, outer planets Uranus, Mercury, Pluto, Neptune, Nibiru, and 100 billion, million billion galaxies, and the central sun. This is a planetary ascension that involves all these and many more for which we do not remember or know the names. Some of you have vague memories of coming from these places. President Obama has the technology to link through video from Camp David to these missions in space, communicating with these astronauts. Twin brothers, and both of them commanders of the ISS, Mark and Scott Kelly, helped Gabrielle Giffords, who was on the House of Representatives Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, recover from a gunshot wound to the brain in a black ops attempt to take her life. Gabby is married to Mark Kelly, and he is now retired from the space program. He had logged more miles to the ISS from the space shuttle than any other before he retired. It is time to end the truth embargo. In the post-Nassara world, transportation, which now is all polluting and petroleum-based, will go away. Zero-point devices and energies will be non-polluting, inexpensive, and complementary to our development. Most factories and power plants and highways will no longer be appropriate. We will be using anti-gravity lifting devices of many types that require no such support systems. Since every particle of matter and spirit is upgrading, even our present homes will upgrade with us until we are ready and desiring to move to the crystal cities and restore the old areas to pristine natural areas. Tabletop 3D copiers, replicators, and organic gardens with new seeds and new technologies are the two most important aspects of our new living arrangements. We will want everything in our homes and everything we eat and wear to be non-toxic to us and others. I can tell you that the ship's replicators can make anything you can imagine exactly the way you most desire it, to look and taste and yet be completely healthy and supportive of our new crystalline structures. New ways to communicate in many modes will replace our current commercial systems. I will be at the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure April 29th to May 3rd because I feel it is one of the most important events we will ever witness in our lifetimes. I invite you, I implore you, I beseech you, to be there too, asking for the change which you desire to see, either live or live stream. We will do this together, and we will do this with love. Please sign the petition now. Please share it so we may obtain quickly the 100,000 signatures it deserves. So this I put out on March 26th. Now on March 29th, in BBC News, we have this update. I think this is absolutely hysterical. And it makes me wonder if someone out there is listening. This is on the front page today. The Soyuz spacecraft docks at ISS after just 6 hours. Hysterical. This is such a joke, but this is how media works. They're giving little tastes of what they're going to have to tell you pretty soon anyways. We're going to have to rewrite all of history, and they don't want you to be too mad at them, so they're giving you a little nonsense article along the way. This is hysterical. A Soyuz space capsule was docked at the International Space Station after a journey of less than 6 hours. The three-man crew is the first to take the quicker route, involving just four orbits. The journey normally takes 2 days for a Russian spacecraft. The arrival of Russians Pavel Vinogradov and Alexander Misurkin and Chris Cassidy of the U.S. bring the number of crew at the ISS to 6. The crew launched from Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan, that was where Sputnik launched from, eh? After liftoff at 2043 GMT, the Soyuz capsule then entered orbit and using intricate ballistic maneuvers. I gotta read that again. It made my whole week. After liftoff at 2043 GMT, the Soyuz capsule then entered orbit using intricate ballistics maneuvers. Succeeded in cutting out around 30 orbits and 45 hours from the flight time to the ISS. Prior to the flight, the shortened route had been successfully tested 3 times by Russian Progress cargo ships, which were unmanned versions of the Soyuz that transport supplies to the ISS. The 3 new arrivals are due to return to Earth in September. The other 3 members of the ISS crew arrived in December and will leave in May. Over the next 6 months, the crew will perform 137 investigations on the U.S. operating segment of the station and 44 on the Russian segment, according to a statement from the U.S. Space Agency, NASA. NASA said that the investigation will cover human research, biological and physical science, technology development, Earth observation, and education. Not one word of that article is true, except for the names of the guys, maybe, who were there. Adorable. Well, we're coming forward, but really I'd like us to press the fast forward button. So if you can help me, go sign that petition, because it makes a difference. You know, we're giving media the permission it needs to come forward to the 21st century. Ay, ay, ay. So where are we? We really would like to, on this program, look at these wonderful witnesses that are coming forward for the citizens' hearing. And today I'd like to feature Peter Davenport. Peter Davenport has been director of the National UFO Reporting Center since 1994. Peter reports UFO sighting cases regularly on the Jeff Renz and the Coast to Coast radio programs, and presents lectures on specific UFO cases, most notably the Phoenix Lights sighting. Peter's work has been featured in a front page article on the Los Angeles Times in 2008, and he has appeared on the Larry King live television program. In addition to being the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter has served as director of investigations for the Washington State chapter of the Mutual UFO Network. Peter has had an active interest in the UFO phenomena from his early boyhood. He experienced his first UFO sightings over St. Louis Municipal Airport in the summer of 1954. So I want to share a video with you, and this one is a Coast to Coast broadcast with Peter Davenport. I'm starting it a few seconds in. So enjoy this, everybody.
George, and thank you very much for having me on. It's always an exciting adventure to appear on this program. I'm delighted to be back, and I'd like to begin by thanking all those ladies and gentlemen who
Okay, we have to reload, everybody. Sorry about that.
Before reporting, up next, Peter Davenport. He experienced it on the program as well. Peter, how are you?
I am doing well, George, and thank you very much for having me on. It's always an exciting adventure to appear on this program. I'm delighted to be back. And I'd like to begin by thanking all those ladies and gentlemen who submitted reports of their sightings on or about the 4th of July this year in response to my appearance back on the 6th of July, I think it was. We got a slew of reports from Coast to Coast listeners.
What do you think folks were seeing? Because I got all kinds of emails as well, Peter. You were on with us a couple days after Independence Day.
Yep.
What do you think was up there in the sky?
Well, I don't know, George, and that's not unusual. People call me to claim the things they've seen, to describe the things they've seen, and I rarely know, rarely able to identify positively what it is they've seen. but I was going through data, going through our database just before the program. We got about 185 reports just for the evening of the 4th of July. But I started scrolling back through the data we collected, and this phenomenon appears to have started as early as the first week of June. So it's been going on, or it went on, for about 7 weeks. And it's tempting to say, well, these objects clearly were nothing but Chinese or Japanese lanterns, pyrotechnic devices, essentially, hot air lanterns. But I don't think they were, based on what people have told me about their sightings.
No, not at all. So let's put that one aside for now. What else are you getting these days, Peter?
We're getting all sorts of interesting reports, Jeff George. And the one thing that has occurred to me this month, you know, UFO investigators have been saying for decades, almost ever since the beginning of this phenomenon back in June of 1947, when we first awakened to what was going on, that some kind of full disclosure or some kind of landing is going to take place imminently. It hasn't happened in those 47 or more, well, 62 years, I guess, now. But based on the volume and the nature of the reports that I've been getting, that question has been surging back and forth in my mind. These are really interesting reports that I've been getting over the last 7 months, and that, or roughly 7 weeks, I should say, and the sightings are dramatic. They're an overt display of multiple objects seen over populated areas and witnessed by many people. I don't believe I've seen a phenomenon like that since I started this job 16 years ago.
And Peter, are these reports getting better? By that I mean, are the people who are reporting whatever these things are they more concise? Are they reporting these stories better?
Thank you for that question. I wish that were the case, George. But what has happened is, it's since the advent of the cell telephone, people have gotten a little bit careless. In fact, a lot of the calls 5 years ago, I would say maybe 5% of the calls I was getting were prank or hoax calls. Some days, currently, I would say between 50 and 80% of the calls that come in over our hotline are prank calls. That's unfortunate, and it may compel me to stop using the hotline. People may leave messages, but I'm not going to answer it in a live fashion. But the other thing, with regard to the written reports, which we always ask for, a follow-up written report to any phone call or conversation, is a lot of people are submitting their reports, I presume, via texting. Uh-huh. And the quality of their text, I have to say, is lower than I wish were the case. But we're grateful for any report we get. If people see what they believe may have been a UFO, I'll take a report in any form just to get the information.
Well, you know, do you have caller ID on the National UFO Reporting Center hotline? Because if you don't, you should. Then you can, if they don't call you with a legitimate number, don't pick it up.
Yeah.
If you have a legitimate number and they're still pranking you, then at least you'll have a number and you can call them back at 7 in the morning and wake them up and stuff like that.
We've thought of that many times. I hate to return a prank with a prank, but just yesterday, ironically, for the first time, we had a young fellow who called from Casey, Iowa. He called here 26 times in rapid sequence. One of the most foul-mouthed young little preteens that I've ever heard in my life, I think.
He may be the same idiot who emails us 70 times a day, by the way.
Yeah.
But we're closing in on his IP address, Peter.
Good. Well, yeah. It's unsettling to me to see how many people we have in our society who don't seem to engage in their affairs in a serious-minded fashion and whose principal form of entertainment seems to be to pester or annoy other people who are trying their level best to do productive work. And
well, they think
we can stop that.
Absolutely. Understand you're thinking of betting the folks at SETI. What's that all about?
Well, I'm pleased to talk about that, George. For the last 15 years, I have been trying to awaken the UFO community to the fact that We now have the technology. Because of the dramatic developments in computers, because of the presence of the global positioning system that has a very, very accurate time constant on it, we should be able to get to graduate from taking eyewitness reports to actually directly registering or measuring, detecting the presence of UFOs in the near-Earth environment. This is a paper. I wrote a paper in preparation for the 2004 MUFON Symposium in Denver, to which I'd been invited to speak. And I proposed that what we build is what is known as a passive radar system, would cover most of the North American continent. Just two or three stations, we could cover most of the North American continent. And I have, which is available over my website, ufocenter.com, that we could detect UFOs out to a distance of about 250,000 statute miles from the surface of our planet. Once we are able to do that, the skeptics and the debunkers and the government are suddenly passengers, because we're going to be able to show definitively if UFOs are real and if they reflect electromagnetic radiation or radio waves, then we can show that they are there. And I'm very excited about this project. And I think the reason SETI comes into the picture is I think that if we are able to build one of these systems, and I hope we will in the near future, we can show, before SETI can show, that we are not the only sentient life in our galaxy and therefore the universe. That's what I would like to do.
That's Peter Davenport to work. Working at the National Reporting Center for UFOs. He'll be one of the witnesses at the citizens' hearing. Next thing I would like to do today is share with you a special presentation from Dr. Richard Hoagland. And it's called The Case for Ancient Artificial Structures in the Solar System. I really think you'll enjoy this. So sit back, relax. This is some information you may never have heard before. It's very cool. Enjoy this.
As I said, the case for structures built by someone on worlds which surround us. And the implied extension of that is the implication of those structures. In fact, that's what we're all here this morning to discuss. If this is all real, if over the last 20 years, the NASA data and the independent analysis has in fact shown us real stuff out there, then what does it mean? I want to thank Chris Gould. This is a brilliant, brilliant synthesis of seminal ideas. Some of you may recognize the figures at the top. Some of you may recognize the figure in the center. But what you may not know is that this derives directly. I mean, Steven Spielberg did not originate E.T.'s finger touching humankind. It was a gentleman a bit more removed named Michelangelo, who for 12 years, lying on his back, painting the Sistine Chapel ceiling, limned out the potentials between the ineffable in some other space, some other dimension, some other reality, reaching out and breathing life literally into mankind. Now, that's what we're here to discuss today. That painting is in the Sistine Chapel, as I noted a moment ago, which, of course, is in this place. This is St. Peter's in Rome, in the Vatican, a place where a few days ago a very interesting ceremony took place, the 25th anniversary of the pontificate of Pope John Paul II. It is Rome which is, in every essence, the center of Christendom, of people who believe in a divine origin of Jesus Christ, of that ineffable reaching out and touching mankind in a very literal way. It is also Rome, which is the center of other things. For instance, in addition to this side of Rome, there is this side of Rome. And as a matter of fact, when Mike and I kind of put this all together, I must say that there were times in thinking of what we were going to do in coming here that I felt a little bit like this. Now, anybody recognize this picture? Charlton Heston, all right? Ben-Hur. Who has not seen Ben-Hur 15, 20 times? Please raise your hand. What you don't know is that those chariots have very deep symbolic meaning. Now, for those of you who have followed our work over the years, you know that one of the things that we have gotten involved in addition to the science and the data and following the numbers, is following the ritual. It turns out that this discussion of the interface, the boundary between religion and this other solar system reality, is very ancient. In fact, we're going to have some discussion in the next couple of hours by David Flynn of just how ancient and how extraordinary that connection has been. David is doing some pretty interesting work, and I'm looking forward to what he's going to say to us this morning, because one of the things that he's going to touch upon is the background to those chariot races. Because this guy is none other than Mars, the god of war, who is in essence the patron god of Rome, of the Roman Empire. Now, this is a statue that was raised shortly after Julius Caesar was killed in a temple dedicated to Mars Ultor, Mars the Avenger, Mars who was called upon to avenge the death of the Roman Emperor, which set in motion a whole series of historical events and created ultimately the greatest empire that up until that time the world had ever seen. Well, that empire, the Roman Empire, was dedicated to none other than the planet Mars. Now, we flash forward the film. This is 2003, fall. This has been the year of Mars because of all times in the past 60,000 years, on the evening of August 27th of this year, Mars came closer than it's been for some 60,000 years. 6 times 10,000 years. I mean, that's an extraordinary, unimaginable amount of time. It is our potential position, and I say that carefully, that a lot of interesting history, to which we are now just beginning to be privy, has taken place in those 60,000 years. And in fact, the last time Mars was that close, very different perspectives and very different sets of eyes from this planet and from other planets watched that event, marked its passing in a way that modern history does not record. This is Mars as it appears in the night sky. In the late 20th century, early 21st century, Mars, as you can see, this was a shot taken on the 17th of July of this year with an amateur telescope from Florida as Mars passed behind the moon, as seen that night from that strip of real estate on planet Earth. Mars appears no bigger than an average crater on the moon. So for all of recorded history for the last, 6,000 years or so, and certainly within scientific history, the last couple hundred years or so, after the invention of the telescope and the perfection of that kind of technology, all that we thought we knew about that place has been gained from a disk that you can literally cover in a telescope with your little finger, even with some of the highest magnification. What we need to do to change our perspectives historically from looking at it far away is to create a whole new technology, namely the space age, which, of course, in 1976 sent 2 unmanned Viking probes for the first time to land on Mars. And what did the orbiters that didn't land but kept cruising around taking pictures, what did they discover? But one afternoon on July 25th, I believe, 1976, they took a picture of a region called Cydonia. a picture that looked like this. And because it looked so extraordinarily different than any scientist that JPL or NASA or Caltech or whatever had ever imagined, what happened to that view? Well, the first reaction, the first official reaction I heard myself, I was a member of the press, I was working for CBS, and I was also an NASA consultant back then. I was in the JPL press room, Von Karman Auditorium, when Jerry Sopin, who was the Viking Project scientist, said, when this picture was popped up on the screen, isn't it peculiar what tricks of lighting can do? When we took it and took an image a few hours later, it all went away. That has been the position of NASA for the last 30-some years.
There's a picture of the face on Mars.
Went away.
Which is Mother Sekhmet, right?
Now, what I'm going to show you is that the data has not gone away. In fact, with each new mission, with each new set of images, with each new discipline applied to this problem, and we'll talk about what we mean by disciplines, because there's a range of technologies now that have been brought to bear on this problem, not just imaging. The problem of the face on Mars has not gone away. It's gotten deeper, more profound, more provocative, and more insidious. What do I mean by insidious? What I mean is a polarization between the official view, the political view of an agency and a government that cannot countenance that this could possibly be real. And a public and a band of independent scientific investigators who for the last 20-some years have been pursuing, sometimes at great cost and against great odds and great opposition, the truth. The simple scientific truth. Is this thing a real artifact lying on a place where it does not belong? And if it is such an artifact, what does it mean? Both scientifically, politically, philosophically, and the reason we're all here this morning, religiously. This quote from, of course, Genesis is a profound perspective on the problem. Because what it does is canonize the particular religious perspective that human beings and the human likeness of human beings is endemic to one place only, namely here. So if you find an image, particularly an image of such striking, astonishing likeness to a human image, lying in a place where it has no business being, namely there, what does it do to this perspective? We have two very noted authors with us today, scientists, researchers, theologians, men of curiosity, depth, and perspective, to tell us what they think this could mean if the data is accepted as bona fide. What I'm going to do in the next hour and 15, 20 minutes is to give you my perspective on what it can mean, because from the data that I'm going to show you, I would say now that I'm probably 99% convinced that it's real, and this quote must be addressed in its full dimension of the human condition and the future of all of us on planet Earth. Now, there's another perspective, which is the scientific perspective. You have your religious people, namely the folks that say that God created man here and nowhere else. And then you have scientists. Now, this is from George Gaylord Simpson, who was one of the seminal evolutionary biologists of the 20th century. I quote him extensively in The Monuments of Mars because his perspectives really encapsulated a whole scientific point of view. Let me quote what he said. Among all the myriad forms of matter and of life on Earth, as far as we know, in the universe, man is unique. He happens to represent the highest form of organization of matter and energy that has ever happened. Now, I find a striking parallel between that statement and this statement. I mean, a parallel which is eerie, These two points of view, faith and science, when it comes to the human condition, when it comes to man, an old term obviously including all of us, basically have one perspective, that we're it, that we are unique, one of a kind. In fact, there are some people among us who I have heard recently state that out of the literally trillions of possible worlds in the universe available to the Hubble technology, this is it. So please enjoy lunch today. I mean, you guys are the only ones that will, according to this perspective. Now, when you look at the Earth in its proper context, set against the background of just one galaxy, the Milky Way, of something between 100 and 400 billion suns, I just have a problem with the idea that we're that unique, just philosophically. I think Carl in Contact phrased it best when he had Ellie and her father, you know, have these colloquies through time. Then when she met him, you know, in that other dimension, wherever she went, and he looked up and she looked up and he said, if we're all there is, it's an awful waste of space. I mean, if the biblical quotation, the heavens declareth his handiwork, has any meaning, it's got to be beyond just 400 billion suns in this galaxy alone. The universe, stars, has been there a long time, will be there a very long time. So what is so special about it that it declareth his handiwork? Now, if you add the idea of intelligence, if you add the idea of cosmic soap opera, I mean, that's something extraordinary, at least to my perspective. Because that gives you now 400 billion in this galaxy alone, remember, out of trillions of galaxies, 400 billion stages for consciousness to appreciate what's going on in this cosmos that from that perspective has been created for intelligence. So that's part of what I think is going to happen in our discussion tonight, because I am of the opinion very firmly, even before I found the data that I'm presenting, that there is a lot more going on in heaven and earth than has been dreamed of in many, many, many philosophies, which brings us back to this. Because when I tripped over this back in 1983, I had to be dragged kicking and screaming, as I describe in Monuments, to the position that this, in fact, could be real, because I was a kind of a devotee of this Gaylord Simpson point of view, which is I'd bought into the evolutionary model that it took trillions of random steps to create what we see around us, and the odds that anything like that could ever be randomly created again were literally astronomical. But if you take out the random part, if you begin to look that there's something else going on, that there's an intelligence, maybe with a big I, maybe with a small I, but there's intelligence imbued in that structure, things completely change. So, this is the place that Lowell viewed through his telescopes and drew lines and canals and imagined that maybe there was someone home at the dawn of the last century. When I say that, I mean now not the 19th, but the 20th century. It's hard to imagine we're 3 years into the 21st century, and it takes you 2 hours to go through an airport. Anyway, on this planet, there is a region called Cydonia. This Cydonia is the one on Mars. It was named by Giovanni Virginio Schiaparelli. As I began to do the research and put together the various teams of the independent investigation and do the science that NASA had demonstrably not done, and we'll get to that in a minute, and ultimately summarized all of this in the first editions of the Monuments of Mars back in 1987, one of the things that I was struck by very early on was, if this is real, if this guy is real, then somehow, if the Simpson model holds, and human beings are unique to here, or if the religious model holds, and God created mankind here, if you find a statue next door, it doesn't take a rocket scientist. Well, actually, it does take a rocket scientist to get us there, you know. But it doesn't take somebody with lots of brains to figure out that maybe, just maybe, us guys made it. And it is trying to tell us guys something more than we know now. So at the very essence of the problem, there has got to be potentially a connection between this place, this Cydonia, and planet Earth. And that is what I wrote in the first edition back in 1987 of The Monuments of Mars. In fact, this was the chapter that I wrote describing my search. And I started it with a quote because I just thought, you know, Arthur's an old friend of mine, and Arthur just encapsulates these gems that resonate with you for decades. I mean, I wouldn't be standing up here if it weren't for Arthur Clark. So I put his quote, because long before this data stared us in the face, Arthur said, "The rash assertion that God created man in his own image is ticking like a time bomb at the foundation of many faiths. The ticking is getting louder because the data is getting stronger. And I am so pleased to look out and see this room filled. We had a bigger room, it would be filled, because this is an idea, this is a conversation whose time has come. And we forthrightly, with your absolute sterling participation and showing up, and, you know, what was it? I forget who said that 90% of life is just showing up. Woody Allen. Okay, well, he was right. And you guys have done your part by showing up. We're going to try to get other places in the University of Wisconsin to pick up this ball and to run with it, because this conversation needs to take place all over the country. In fact, all over the world. We have to know what it is we're dealing with, and we have to give people a sense of being able to talk about it before it hits them, oh, I hate this, in the face. I can see that coming. My mind is, you know, it's going there, and there's no way to stop. I'm going to fall right. Anyway, by the way, would someone kind of give me how much time I have? I have an hour. Okay. Okay, lots of time. He doesn't know me. Lots of time. Lots of time. Okay. I may go a little over. I just want to warn you. Okay. But it'll be worth it, as you'll see. There are some surprises. So I have been searching and thinking and pondering on this conundrum, this what I find is the most intractable and fascinating problem, which is, if this stuff on Mars is real, if the face is real and the other stuff we're going to talk about, what does it mean? How do we enter the equation? And in fact, as I wrote in Monuments, I saw back now 20-some years ago that if this was real, it was a almost carbon copy of the scenario laid out in Arthur and Stanley's seminal film, novel, et cetera, et cetera. 2001. Because it somehow bespoke of an intervention in the nursery, in another model, by something ineffable, something alien, something from out there that left a monument to that intervention. And of course, 20 years ago, we didn't know what we know now, and we didn't have a lot of the clues as to the dimensions of that potential intervention. And again, we're going to have a really rollicking good time discussing that and other things this evening, because the potential for that intervention directly assaults the superficial reading of Genesis. And there is no other way to say it than that flatly. If aliens have somehow intervened in the human condition. If they exist and have played God, then the chronology and the scriptures and the texts, not only of Christians, but of all faiths. I mean, I wish we had 2 or 3 days, and I wish we had Muslims up here, and we had Buddhists, and we had, you know, a stripe of every potential perspective on who we are and why we are here. Because in order to tackle this, we have to tackle it with nothing less than the whole of the human value system, which has looked at and asked questions as to why we exist from time immemorial. Finally, now we have potential data, which I'm going to move along, won't get to answer some of these extraordinary questions. And it's time we enter the conversation so that everybody comes up the curve at the same time. Well, that connection, that search, brings us back to Rome. Because Rome, as an empire devoted to the god Mars, the Roman Empire extended from the British Isles all the way up here, all the way down to Egypt, span of several thousand miles, covering the entire Mediterranean region. And you can see it in the architecture. If you go to Rome today, you will find something that looks eerily like this. This is the obelisk of Hatshepsut, who was one of the few female pharaohs of Egypt in its heyday. Well, in Vatican Square, standing right in front of the icon of Christendom, St. Peter's, there is an obelisk which was borrowed from Egypt by the Romans and brought to Rome. Now, why were they intrigued with Egypt? Why did Caesar go to Egypt? Think about the connections between some of what we're going to talk about in terms of Egypt's connections to more distant and ancient places, and what Rome, in the personification of the worship of its god, did with that same information. Anyway, Rome was a descendant of a culture on this peninsula, namely the Greek culture. That's why many times it's called Greco-Roman. You can actually trace, and David is going to trace, a progression of civilizations that have kept sacred the same stuff, have regurgitated it, have reformulated it, have repackaged it. But when you strip away the superficial things, it seems eerily to extend back to Mars. Now, it certainly extends to the concept of Mars, to the concept of a godhood, of a deity to be worshipped. But we're making an even bolder proposal. We're saying that the data now supports the theory, the hypothesis, that in fact it could physically extend back to Mars. And let me tell you how, all right? If you look on an island called Crete in the Mediterranean, you will see a city no longer exists, lost to now forever in time, a city called Sidonia. That was the origin of the name of Sidonia on Mars. By way of an astronomer, an Italian astronomer, in 1877, Giovanni Virginio Schiaparelli, the same Schiaparelli who saw canals and started Lowell on his trek. Schiaparelli was a classicist, and as you'll see in a little while, it wound up with him renaming all of the features on Mars, including some provocative names. Here's one called Eden. Wonder what he meant by that. Anyway, so if you look a little further at the Mediterranean, at the eastern extent of the Roman Empire, you'll see a little city up here on the coast of Syria called Sidon. David is going to get into some very interesting information regarding Sidon, because it turns out that we can trace concepts and beliefs of the people who lived in Sidon, who is another variant of Sidonia. And you'll find that what they believed and where that information came from strengthens the case that we're dealing with a legacy of information. Now, if in fact the information vis-a-vis what's waiting at Sidonia came by circuitous means from a place that is named after Sidonia, except it was transposed. The terrestrial form in historical terms preceded the Martian form in our current nomenclature and current maps and current ideas. Ultimately, it all revolves around this piece of real estate, which is inarguably the most contentious piece of real estate in the world. Is that an accident? Is that just chance? Or does this potential connection to a profound link between these two worlds, which seems to have touched ground here in some form at a very ancient time, as David will limb out, is it possibly responsible for the current problems in Iraq, in Iran, in Syria, and above all, between Israel and all its Arab neighbors? Is it possible that the greatest threat facing mankind in the 21st century ultimately stems from this clash of cultural perspectives around the seminal idea that we have been tinkered with from somewhere else? Do you remember back in 1997 when NASA sent Pathfinder to Mars and two guys from Yemen sued NASA in the court system claiming that NASA was infringing on their family history and preserve and their culture and their family derived from Mars? No one noticed. No one paid attention. We did. Because my question is, what do they perchance know that no one else knows? Now, getting through the filters from our culture, particularly now that events past September 11th have taken place, to their culture is almost impossible. What do they think they know? So this then was the extent of the Roman Empire. And in Rome itself, there are many monuments. The Forum, which is where Caesar spoke and was killed. There's the temple of Mars Altor is back there in the distance. The temple to Mars, the god of war. And if you look at Rome's history in toto, Romulus and Remus, the mythological sons of the war god, were said to have founded Rome. The Romans were therefore known as the sons of Mars. The Roman Empire was the first that we know of specifically dedicated to Mars. Ancient Rome's New Year began March 1, the month of Mars. And finally, Sally priests, who were dedicated to Mars, are the origin of our term salute. And their key ritual dates include March 19th to 23rd. This is a little footnote. This is the year of Mars, right? If Mars is somehow involved at a deep, fundamental, archetypal level in the turbulent history of the Middle East, particularly in Iraq, the ancient home of Sumer, the first known civilization out of nowhere, out of nothing, isn't it interesting that the war began March 19th? And it had to happen on a clock. It's now obvious that that war had to happen on a clock. Why? Well, in all of the iterations of monuments over the last, 20-some years, almost 20 years, from 87 to 2003, I have been pursuing this idea of a celestial-terrestrial connection. That if we're looking at real data, if there really is a face and other structures, pyramids, an organized complex, some kind of urban center, some kind of civilization that we are looking down by remote sensing and looking at with satellite imagery, then there has to be, because of the centerpiece of that potential civilization, there has to be a discoverable connection. And I started looking in the direction of Egypt. Now, a lot of you who heard me on art know that I have talked a lot about the surprising, shocking connection of many modern institutions to ancient Egypt, a discovery that we simply, you know, couldn't fathom at the time. We now have a bit of a better perspective, but initially it didn't make any sense. Now, of course, if you undergird that historical displacement of data that doesn't make sense with a foundation of Mars behind us all, if in fact the human condition can trace its connections back to Cydonia, back to Mars, back to whatever happened there, and we're seeing in Egypt as the first touch point on this planet in monumental form, its emergence here, then things begin to make a little more sense. And as I said, the guy who's going to make a great deal of sense of this, who's carrying on in a sterling way this tradition of looking for this connection, and who will regale you with some pretty intriguing surprises, including what these things are, all right? I mean, this is really cool, is David Flynn, and I'm dying to see and hear what he has to say later on this morning. Now, another guy who is not with us, but whose presence is very much felt, is this individual, Stanley V. McDaniel. Dr. McDaniel was the professor and former chairman of the Department of Philosophy of Sonoma State University. Back in 1992, he called me up, and he began an independent research project at a university in California looking into the potential reality of the Martian data. He ultimately found so much to write about that he was forced to put together a very large document. We have the only surviving copies. It's now out of print, called the McDaniel Report, of what is in essence a peer review by a world-class epistemologist and historian of science, Professor McDaniel, of all the independent investigations over the last 20 years into this ineffable enigma. And in the sciences, everyone knows that peer review is critical. If you don't have that outside break, that outside perspective, that outside refereed view of what you're doing, it's so easy to go wrong. That's what the whole peer review process is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a colloquy among peers that results in a distillation of truth. Well, Stan McDaniel represents to this investigation in all its many forms conducted by all of the independent research community from literally one ocean to the next and even overseas, that peer review. He came to this as a newborn babe. In his own words, he says some very seminal things. For instance, in his summary, this is how he characterized the role of NASA and the rest of us in assessing the reality of what's on Mars. Then he adds, however, during the 17 years, this was written in 1992-93, during the 17 years since the controversial landforms were discovered, 76, NASA has maintained steadfastly there is no credible evidence that any of the landforms may be artificial. A close look at NASA's arguments reveals that NASA's evaluation has consisted largely of initial impressions from unenhanced photographs, heavily weighted by faulty reasoning, and that NASA has failed to apply special methods of analysis. It has relied upon flawed reports. It has failed to attempt verification of the enhancements and measurements made by others, and it is focused exclusively on inappropriate methodology, which ignores the importance of context. There remains no scientific basis for NASA's position regarding the Martian landforms. Now, that is his summary after a year of independent work, which resulted in a document which was basically sent to NASA in 1993, and literally 3 days, well, I'll wait. I'll tell you what happened in a while. 3 days after NASA received this document, a few copies of which you can now get for yourselves there. Anyway, this is Schiaparelli's first map of Mars showing the infamous canals. You can see his classical nature because on the polar view with all these place names around the Mediterranean, he put a Grecian vase imagery. I believe this is Helios, the sun god, pulled by the chariot. And it's obvious why he, of all people, would transpose terrestrial mythology to the planet Mars. To a first order, it was simply because he was steeped in this tradition and thought it would solve a lot of problems with people naming Mars regions after their girlfriends and boyfriends. And I mean, there were all kinds of weird names on Mars before Schiaparelli stepped in and kind of standardized the nomenclature. What I strongly suspect, but can't prove yet, is that Schiaparelli had access to some very ancient documentation, which did what David has done and basically buttressed the conclusion that there was more than a casual link between Mars and regions in the Mediterranean. And that's why we wound up with this interesting Ouroboros, the snake eating its own tail, with nomenclature from the Mediterranean going back to Mars maps, et cetera, et cetera. Someday we may have enough information if we get to Mars and find the libraries and find out who wrote the documents that wound up on Earth, that basically wound up back in the Martian libraries, to figure out if any of this is real. But at least it's an interesting hypothesis based on a number of other things that we're going to, between us, show you this morning. This, of course, is the guy who brought Mars that we presently view with some skepticism. This is Percival Lowell. I have the great privilege of going to Lowell with Robin and with Laurie and looking through his 24-inch telescope this summer during the closest approach in 60,000 years. And I'm looking at Mars now just a shade over 35 million miles away. Producing a video documentary, which I'm sure you'll all want to see a copy of when we put it out, giving some background and things that you may not know about Lowell and his role in all of this. But more than any other individual, Lowell's Mars gave us the Mars that we thought we would see in the 50s when we sent spaceships to land on Mars and to take stock of what was there. Now, what I find fascinating, going back to this Mediterranean-Roman link, is that one of the things that were projected in the artwork of my dear departed friend, Chesley Bonstell, who was the first premier space illustrator of the 20th century, who gave birth to a whole host of descendants and devotees and followers of equal artistry and talent, was the transposition of this kind of ruin in downtown Rome into this eerie setting before a Martian dawn. This is what we expected to see. This is what fueled, in fact, at some level still fuels, our fascination, I believe, with Mars. We really hope that someone at one time was home. One footnote, notice how thin the columns are compared to the Roman forum in the previous slide. That's because Chesley was trying to account for the lighter Martian gravity, which would, of course, produce a smaller diameter for the supporting columns for equal weight, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the reality, of course, hit us smack in the face in 76, because when this mission went to Mars, as I noted before, among the sand dunes and craters and basically desolate, lifeless environment that we thought that NASA had bequeathed us with these unmanned missions, suddenly this thing appeared. And it was a shock. It was a shock to NASA then, it's a shock to NASA now, and it's becoming a shock to a lot of people the more they become aware that this is a possibility just next door. Now again, this is what Jerry Sofen said. Well, a trick of lighting. In 1980, two gentlemen at Goddard, DiPietro and Molinar, who were independent imaging experts, who worked, I believe, for Lockheed on Landsat imagery at the time, they located the second Viking frame that NASA claimed back then did not exist. This is the original frame on the left. This is 7013 on the right. And as you can see at a higher sun angle, the facial features match point for point and eyeball for eyeball. This is what it's called independent confirmation. But how did the scientific community respond to these two independent contractors' discovery of independent data that tended to confirm that this wasn't just an illusion? In fact, it was a real three-dimensional statue. Well, one of them responded like this in Stan McDaniel's volume. Stan says, my original naive view, he admits he was naive, that all NASA scientists were sincerely interested in the truth, was utterly shattered when I discovered the most blatant piece of disinformation I've ever seen. One written not by an obscure NASA public information employee, but by a prestigious member of the 1976 Viking lander imaging team, Dr. Carl Sagan. Dr. Sagan's contribution to the subject could not be interpreted as mere scientific bungling. Its author was too knowledgeable for that. And what did Carl say that got Stan so upset? Carl looked at this image and basically said in Parade magazine, the face in Sidonia Mars, at left, eerie and haunting. At right, in a separate spacecraft photo, it seems to be an irregular hill. There are fingers. No, where there's smoke, there is fire. Enter this individual. This is Kinthea. She is the resident artiste, sculptress, and artistic director of the Enterprise mission. I have known Kinthea and worked with her for the last 20-some years, since 83. That's 20 years. Good God! Where did the time go? 20. You know, I can't believe I'm standing up here and saying glibly 20. I've been at this 20 years. Good grief. Anyway, what Kinthea did was to take these two images and produce the first three-dimensional model long before we had computer image processing that was affordable by us, you know, poor outside independent investigators. She literally took the clay and, based on the high and low sun angle, this one and this one, spent thousands of backbreaking. I mean, have you ever stood over, working with clay? It literally is backbreaking. And she has produced some stunning work, which ultimately was good enough, I felt, to be included as the cover shot of the first edition of the Monuments of Mars. This is her image, her clay model, as you would see it from the city looking across toward the eastern horizon, toward the dawn, photographed by Dan Drayson. Actually a model about this big, shot from one end. Many years later, another member of this dramatis personae, Dr. Mark Carlotto, who was a respected engineer from Carnegie Mellon, worked with highly classified and black and top secret DOD projects and image processing, is probably one of a handful of world-class image processing experts, came to our merry little band, devoted a great deal of time, and produced the first quantitative digital three-dimensional analysis, some of which was published in Applied Optics in 1988. What Mark did was to take the two-dimensional Viking data and via a technology called photoclinimetry, better known as shape from shading, which is an algorithm that kind of calculates 3D things from Lambert scattering laws and sun angles and geometry and puts it all together and gives you a three-dimensional structure with a couple of assumptions. He produced this rotation back in 88 of the infamous face on Mars. Now, the cool thing is that when you compare Kinthea's analog model here with Mark's digital model there, two different techniques, two different people, two different genders, two different coasts, they're the same, separated by, I think it was 3 or 4 years. Now, that's cool. That is independent confirmation of the reality, the objective reality. And, of course, what this did was, for once and for all, for any objective observers, throw in the ash can, the NASA canard, oh, it's only a trick of light and shadow. Boy, if we had patented that phrase or trademarked it or something, we would be able to fund the Enterprise mission. Hint, hint. Now, Mark has published, as well as, you know, Dr. Horace Crater and Stan McDaniel and many other individuals, a series of technical papers in the journals. It's very hard to get Sidonia into the journals. Tom Van Plandern tried with Nature and was told absolutely flat out that Nature had put Sidonia on the prescribed list of topics it would, over its dead body, ever cover scientifically. The prejudice in the scientific community against the idea, even the idea that there might be an ancient civilization elsewhere in the solar system, is absolutely profound. It is redolent. You can cut it with the proverbial knife. This is not science. This is political science. But despite these problems, there have been over the years a series of papers published in peer-reviewed journals, technical journals, of the stature of these that were on the screen, of various aspects of the problem of potential artifacts on planet Mars. So for NASA to say that this has never been within the mainstream scientific community is another absolute falsehood. It has. It's simply being assiduously ignored by the space agency and the political structure which supports it. Now, one of the other things that Mark did was to bring satellite technology from the intelligence world that had been used in, among other things, the first Gulf War, looking at satellite imagery with an eye toward distinguishing natural objects from artificial objects. This is called a fractal technology, based on the idea that natural landscapes are self-similar, and if you have an artificial object like a tank sitting on a natural surface, you will get a deviation in measuring pixels in a computer that will allow you to make a educated inference as to the degree of artificiality, and then you target the tank with a tow missile, and bingo, you're in the scenario that is currently going on. Well, Mark took the same technology and applied it to Mars. This is an example. This is a picture of, I think, a B-52 at some Air Force base. I think it's Otis Air Force Base up in New England. Used to live not far from there. And this is the computer fractal plot, and the brightest thing in the image is the most non-natural, non-fractal, i.e. artificial. And when you apply this to the face on Mars, lo and behold, the face stands out as the most non-natural of any object down there. Which back in 1992, when these results were published, caused me in that edition of Monuments to basically say that the face was not carved like Mount Rushmore, but in fact was probably made of artificial stuff. It was built. It was a construction. It was high technology, not simple sandstone or Mount Rushmore lying on the Sidonia Plain. Now, if you look carefully at these plots, this is now background on Mars for the fractal results. This is the face. You'll notice that the curve is steeper and the separation at midpoint from the natural slope line is greater than the one for the tank. Now, this is the plot. This is the terrestrial standardization. Here's the tank. Here's the face. Notice the curve is sharper and the separation from the line greater for the face on Mars than for the most outstanding unnatural object in the Iraqi desert during the Gulf War. Oh, this is an analysis of the whole Sidonia region showing that the most non-fractal things on the planet in that region are the fort in the city. I'll show you that in a minute. And the face is way out there. Now, has NASA paid any attention at all to these numerical results? No. Which brings us back to McDaniel, because he said, the use of enhancement imagery to compensate for inherent characteristics of satellite and spacecraft photography is standard. Methods of image cleanup, magnification, digital analog contrast control, photoclinimetry, and fractal analysis used by the researchers are proven procedures based upon the most advanced technology. He's talking about us guys. The researchers who have developed this data are qualified and experienced professionals. That's McDaniel talking about Carlotto. Research results have been confirmed in several instances by cross-comparison between techniques and between different Viking frames. That's the fractal versus the visual imagery, etc. Geometric measurements at Sidonia, that's our stuff, have been carried out using orthographically rectified images obtained from NASA and the U.S. Geological Survey, and are based upon an official updated control grid. There is no reason to question the validity of the hard data within reasonable tolerances, which, of course, is exactly 180 degrees from what NASA says. He then goes on to say, as my study of the work done by the independent investigators and NASA's response to their research continued, I became aware not only of the relatively high quality of the independent research, but also of glaring mistakes in the arguments used by NASA to reject this research. With each new NASA document I encountered, I became more and more appalled by the impossibly bad quality of the reasoning used. It grew more and more difficult to believe that educated scientists could engage in such faulty reasoning unless they were following some sort of hidden agenda aimed at suppressing the true nature of the data. Now, again, that's not me. That's Professor Stan McDaniel after a year of very hard work. Now, if that's true, it makes what happened in 1993 all the more insidious, because that was the year that we were supposed to send the spacecraft to follow Viking Mars Observer back to Mars and get our next set of pictures of, among other places, if we really, 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 really tried, Sidonia. And NASA, kicking and screaming, and Mike Malin, kicking and screaming even more, said, in essence, over our dead bodies. And then 3 days after McDaniel's report with these scathing indictments of a NASA procedure gone radically wrong, is that an echoed foreshadowing of what the recent CAIB report has said in another dimension of NASA's work, an agency which has gone radically wrong? Is it possible, as I said on Nori's program one night, that because this stuff doesn't kill people, it simply has been simmering in the drawer as an undercurrent for decades with no one paying attention, because, of course, the news media and people in general are only focusing on those things which touch their lives, and when you lose 7 astronauts, that touches your life. But what about losing the history and future of mankind? What's the measure of that? Is that what this agency has really done to us? And have they ultimately shortchanged us for the most profound discussion of all, which is why we are here today, which is, what is the meaning of this? If the ruins are there and they're real and they somehow have touched us, what does it mean for the profound beliefs of human beings all over this planet regarding who they are, where they came from, and why they exist? Those are the questions that must be addressed now as the data gets stronger and stronger. Well, a couple of days after that report was delivered, McDaniel, to NASA, this happened. NASA lost the Mars Observer spacecraft. Poof, just disappeared. And to this day, no one really knows what happened. Why? Because they very cleverly turned off the telemetry just before they were going to make the burn into Mars orbit. Now, without telemetry, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know what happens. You have no information. So the Coffey report, the official review of what happened to Mars Observer, was basically based on guesses. And they guessed it blew up. Well, I guessed it didn't. And I said as much on CNN. And that's a long story. We don't have time to go into it. Fast forward the film now. It's 1997. A spacecraft called Mars Surveyor has just gone into orbit on Mars. By the way, anybody here know the night, the literal date when Mars Surveyor was placed in Mars orbit of 1997? I remember this the other day, and it kind of freaked me out because it's one of those things that you go, whoa, no. September 11th, 1997. That's a whole other conference, okay? Anyway, beginning with Mars Surveyor, we were able to get this image. This is the so-called cat box image made famous by my friend Art, who very appropriately described it, you know, and I will immortalize to my dying day Art's seminal way with words. He said, "Damn it, it looked like a cat box." Because it did. It was taken under the worst lighting, at the worst angle, the worst this, the worst that. And when Dan Rather took one look at it, he said, "Ah, nothing there." That renowned geologist, Dan Rather, of course. And Peter Jennings followed suit and said, "Oh, I don't see any face there." And so that was it. Everybody's gone away. What they don't realize, of course, is that other images have been taken. This is the original Viking high sun angle. This is the cat box image. This is the 2001 full face view. This is the Odyssey view taken a few months ago. All of these images, over and over and over again, when they come out, what does NASA say? This is the high sun angle full face view taken by Mike Malin. Look at this incredible symmetry of the platform. Look at the dimension. Look at the facial features. People who had never been involved in the whole Mars controversy took a look at this picture in an MSNBC poll. It turned out that more people thought that this thing was artificial after the image was made public, even despite the NASA propaganda, than thought before the picture was taken. So there's this disconnect between where people are going with just looking at this thing as the data gets better, and where officialdom has been and continues to be. And, of course, this is the 2001 Odyssey mission, named after Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick's famous film, which I've had high hopes for, and it turns out that this spacecraft has given us some stunning data, which you're going to see momentarily, which is taking us in a whole new direction on this conundrum, and may, in fact, foreshadow a political breakthrough that I'm going to talk about in a minute. This is what NASA has said as of the recent imagery. Now, when the 2001 image came out, this is the date here, May 24, 2001, it used this 26-year-old image of Cydonia, unenhanced with the bit hits and the little nostril from the data dropout and the transmission. In other words, it seems to have decided that history stopped with the first press release back in 76, and we don't care what those damn independent guys think or write or publish. We know this thing is just a pile of rocks, so take it. And they do it again and again and again, except look down here what they say here, which is eerie. It's like there's this doublespeak. It says, "Scientists figured it was just another Martian mesa, common enough around Cydonia, only this one had unusual shadows that made it look like an Egyptian pharaoh." Now, why the heck does NASA have to say it's an Egyptian pharaoh? If it's a pile of rocks, just say it's a pile of rocks. Why connect it ritually to what we know they're doing with all their Egyptian stuff that we don't have time this morning to go into? But you can go to enterprisemission.com and you can see a lot of it there. It turns out, in the history of Viking, Mars Surveyor, and Mars Odyssey, that Cydonia is the most photographed region on the planet Mars, bar none. By principal investigators, Malin and Christian.
Hello, my name is Dr. Mike Abrams.
Sorry, everybody, we got to bring this up again.
Side, which if you tilt your head a little bit to the left, like that, you go that way, you'll see it lines up parallel with the center line. I'll show you some other comparisons so you don't have to imagine what's over here in the darkness. When I saw this, here's the comparison. Here's MGS, full face view. Get this, this is not a dawn image. The 90.3 degrees should have been a dead giveaway. It's pre-dawn. The sun is 0.3 degrees below the horizon. One of our esteemed colleagues from England, I believe, calculated that in order to see the sun, you would have to be 9,000 feet over the face hovering in a spacecraft to see the sun just peeking over the horizon. So this brightness on the eastern side is before the sun has risen. Now, the Martian air is 1/100th of the pressure of the air you're breathing. That means, to a first order, its scattering potential, its scattering brightness, is 100 times less efficient. So pre-dawn at 4:39 in the morning, which is when this photograph was taken, Martian time, is damn dark. It's dark down there. So how come this is so incredibly bright? It's because it's incredibly reflective. Now, one of the possibilities raised by Christensen at Caltech during the JPL seminar on Mars and missions to Mars and all that this summer suggested very obliquely that maybe this brightness was due to snow on the eastern side. Well, this is what snow looks like in our own deserts in New Mexico on Shiprock with the sun actually risen. And you'll notice that snow is a Lambert scatter. It's like this movie screen, all right? It scatters light in all directions. This is not a Lambert scatterer, and it in no way compares. I mean, you can see detail in the shadow, kind of, detail in the shadow, but look how dull this looks in bright sunlight compared to this pre-dawn. Again, I emphasize this is a pre-dawn image. 90.3 degrees. Now, here's what that translates to. This is a Viking image taken just after sunset back in 76 by the Viking lander. All right, you can see shadowy features here. This is the wind cover of the Viking lander. This is some of the surface instruments, the landing pads. This is the horizon. There's a crater on the horizon. This is a bright bluish glow caused by forward scattering in the Martian atmosphere. But notice how dark the landscape is, and this wind cover is gray. You know, it's about 50-60% reflective. Notice how dark it is, and it's a Lambert scatter. It's gray paint. It's basically it's like a movie screen, but it's dark because the Martian pre-dawn or post-sunset is dark. But when we look at the face in that kind of lighting, with the sunlight coming from the northeast, this is the angle, the sun is rising way over here, this is how bright it is compared to what you can see on the left. And the geometry of this indicates that it's coming from that large halo of light above the sun in the atmosphere. It's a diffuse halo, so you don't have sharp shadows. There's no shadow extending out. So that's why this slope, this base of the face is in darkness, because it's tilted away from that light part of the sky, so it's not getting any light at all. It's seeing the sky over here, which is dark, all right? But look at how incredibly bright, and more important, how incredibly geometric the eastern side is. Now, here's a comparison between the Malin image, close-up, 1.5 meter res, and the Odyssey image pre-dawn. Now we begin to see that there are hints of color. Is it possible that this is some kind of glass-like material? Is it prismatically diffracting and refracting this pre-dawn glow as well as reflecting it? And if so, what are the physics of that? Well, Mark Carlotto, many years ago, based on his shape from shading analysis, produced a three-dimensional model that he then proceeded to light in the computer from dawn to dusk. And it turned out this is the lighting that most approximates the current Odyssey lighting that we have, except with Mark's version, the sun was up. It's actually, you know, you can see sunlight coming in. Now, what's interesting is to compare the differences and the similarities in Mark's view. This is his view. This is another Viking shot. This shows you, by the way, how dark the surface is, even when the sun is literally just risen, given the dust and the distance and all that on Mars. Sunrise is a dim phenomenon, as is sunset, but not when you're looking down on the face from orbit. Now, this is a comparison of Mark's computer simulation lit by sunrise and the actual photography. Notice that he got some things right. This ridge here, which we think is part of the facial features, conforms to this, and that slope is very bright as it is here. But his nose reflection and his eye reflections are completely missing here, and it's overwhelmed by all this other stuff going on, which is so geometric that all you can say is it's not a Lambert scatter. It's not a diffuse surface. It's acting much more like a mirror. Now, here are some diffuse surfaces made of natural rock that one of our friends in Sedona, Matt Nelson, took a few weeks ago. This is just before sunset. This is outcroppings, you know, sandstone outcroppings in Sedona. Notice the sunlit side. Notice the away-facing side. Notice that the brightness is actually has nothing to do with what we're seeing in the Odyssey image. Here's another version just before sunset. These buttes are lit by the sun coming like this. Here's the shadow. There's no overwhelming brightness compared to the darkness that we see in the Odyssey data. This is the moon. I think it's a first quarter moon, judging by the angles and when this would have been taken and all that. So how do we explain this astonishing asymmetry in the brightness? Well, I have said from the beginning that this thing was a made object based on the fractal data that Mark gave us back in 1992. This is a model in the computer done by Fred Torres, who works with Kinthea. This is a computer rendering, basically making the face a glass-like specular reflecting surface. And as you can see, it reproduces some of the asymmetry, but not really. In other words, even glass with a front surface reflection doesn't match the incredible brightness of the face on Mars. What does match the brightness is a version of this computer rendering. This is a specular reflection ray trace set of diagrams published on the web that I was able to find. This object is a donut. It's got facets. As you rotate the facets around, the flat planar mirrors catch the light, beam it to the camera, and you see these bright reflections and flash it toward you. I mean, you've all seen the same phenomena flying in the airports where you see windshields or you see sunset on buildings facing the west. Seattle is a good place. Even in Albuquerque, we have some buildings up on the foothills, which at certain times of the afternoon will shine brilliantly. And I've tried taking some pictures, and none of them come out because they overwhelm the CCD pixels of the camera. They're so bright compared to the background. All in all, then, what I believe we're looking at is basically an object which has a mirror-like construction on the eastern side. That, in fact, is an object which has part of its architecture still surviving on the protected side. Remember, the destruction and the winds of Mars come in from the west, so this side has been beaten to hell. This side is more protected. And so this side has the architectural layout and geometry of whatever grand structural foundational architecture that this thing was made of back when it was new. And this data is so profound. Now, again, the reason I can say this with some confidence is based on this fractal data. Notice that even on this side, with the sun coming in from the west, this is the most non-fractal object on the surface. And the bottom line is the face on Mars unequivocally appears to be a manufactured object that does not belong on that Martian landscape. If you look at some of the other nearby objects, it turns out that on this analysis, which is a color image taken looking straight down, pre-dawn, we've got the most incredible, incisive analytical tool that we've ever had. And, of course, my question is, why did we get it? The fact that this came from Arthur's mission, 2001 Mars Odyssey. If you look nearby the face, you'll see objects which appear to be maces. At least that's what they've been called. In fact, if you look very carefully, you'll see that there are checkerboards here and straight lines and an eerie, eerie bluish cast. Now, how can red rocks covered with red oxidized Martian dirt look blue? I mean, where did the blue come from? And if you go closer and rotate with a little more processing, remember, Stan says that we're doing this by the numbers, you find that there is an incredible geometric array of structure across this object with beautiful straight lines, sweeping curves, symmetry. Here's one wing, here's another wing, all right? This is the west wing. Hey, couldn't resist. Sorkin gave us a show, why don't we, you know? This thing may not be a mesa after all. In fact, this is in keeping with some of the data that came out from the infrared study, which I don't have time to go into today, indicating that there's a lot more going on in Cydonia when you get new information, new technology, new tools, than even we potentially speculated even a few years ago. And finally, if you look at this object, this is now another object that at low resolution, you know, it's another mesa, okay. But if you zoom in this color view, pre-dawn, this is what you see. It looks as if this object, again, is strikingly colored blue, indicating short wavelength scattering, internal scattering in some glass-like material, and it's incredibly geometric. It's got boxy stuff, ruined boxy stuff. Look at this beautiful corner of a basically a cube. If you draw the whole thing, this is a ruined set of cubes lying there a mile or so across in this desert, not too far from the face, strikingly different, but just a couple of miles away from the face itself. Now, how on a place where there's supposed to be no geology, where nothing has ever changed, do you get radically different features right next door to each other? On Earth, even with pretty vigorous geology, we find that within a few miles, things tend to be the same. Geological landforms tend to be the same, not apparently at Cydonia. Well, there's a whole bunch of stuff I didn't get to, of course. Hopefully we'll have a chance to get to some of them in our afternoon discussions and our evening Q&A and round robin with the other panelists that I share the stage with. So let me leave you with this thought. We stand at a really important point in the entire 20-year Cydonia investigation. We have almost incontrovertible evidence now that whatever this is, it's not a natural pile of rocks, regardless of what NASA says. What we need is better data of the same kind, pre-dawn or post-sunset shots, and we have formally approached the Mars Express people with the German camera on the European mission going to Mars, and I can make some news by telling you that Dr. Newcomb, who is the principal investigator of the German camera, has assured several Enterprise members in emails that they fully intend to use the 2-meter color camera to attempt to resolve the Cydonia question, including taking pre-dawn and post-sunset imagery, as I called for when I did the show with George some months ago. So, all I can say is stay tuned.
Absolutely fabulous, mind-boggling information. I hope you enjoyed that. I'm not sure if anyone could stick around. We've been going for a couple of hours and 8 minutes now, but I still would like to hold a meditation together for all of us who are left. We're going to do a guided meditation now. The next thing I'm going to say doesn't apply if you're driving your car. Lie down now and make yourself comfortable. Briefly check that your body is straight and then gently close your eyes and mouth. Observe your breath for a few moments. Watch it go in and out. You can use the rhythm of your breath to relax the whole body, tensing each part in turn as you inhale and relaxing it as you exhale. Begin with your feet. Inhale and tense. Exhale and release the tension. Now move to the calves, the thighs, breathing in and out. Breathe into the back and spine. Breathe out and let go of all tension. Continue with the abdomen, the chest, the shoulders, the arms, the neck, tensing during each inhalation and relaxing during exhalation. Then turn your attention to your face, to your scalp, breathing in, letting go. Continue to breathe smoothly, releasing any remaining tension with the outgoing breath. Quiet the mind by letting all your thoughts float away like clouds in a clear blue sky. As you begin to enter the silence of your being, visualize a beautiful garden. Let it be all you wish it to be. Slowly walking into the garden, you see that there is a place where you can leave all your burdens you are carrying with you. The worries, the anger, the frustrations of the day. In fact, any thoughts that are keeping you from being totally happy and free, place them down in the space left for you. Now, look around and notice all the different glorious flowers. Find one that attracts you particularly and sit down in front of it. Look at it. Touch it. Notice the feel of the petals, the stem, the leaves. Inhale its fragrance. Then ask the flower to share its essence with you. Let yourself blend with the flower. Feel yourself as the flower. Notice how you feel being rooted to the ground, how the wind sways you gently in its breeze, the warming rays of the sun. Feel your skin become as the petals and let yourself be bathed in the flower's perfume. The sun begins to set and you become aware of a cool evening breeze, the appearance of stars and the bright silver of the moon, and the healing stillness of the night. With the breaking of the dawn, feel the dew on your petals and merge into the poignant stillness of all nature. Now the sun rises again. You absorb its warming light. Thank the flower for sharing its essence with you. Once more, saturate your being with the scent of the flower and the feeling of oneness you have experienced. Know that you can return to this communion with the flower at any time. Then slowly let the scene fade from your mind. Become aware of your breathing and of your body lying quietly. Slowly begin to move fingers and toes. Take a few deep breaths and stretch your body gently. Turn on to your right side for a moment. Then move onto your left side, keeping the body quite straight. Roll back onto your back, and when you are ready, open your eyes. Observe how you feel. Thank you, everybody, for joining here today. Please come see us on Monday, where we're going to explore the Disclosure Project. I hope you have a most wonderful weekend celebration. Namaste, everybody.